Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, your host and CEO of Literal Humans. Today, we're talking about revolutionizing digital fundraising. We're joined today by Zainab Tariq, co-founder and COO of Cerealbox. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
We're here today to talk about kind of the nonprofit sector and the work that you're doing. One thing you write about in your bio is that you realized the sector was lagging behind in terms of tech adoption, and you kind of set out on a mission to change that. So by way of introduction here, Cerealbox combines growth hacking strategies from marketing with research from the third sector to help charities raise more funds. That's exciting. You've raised over 40 million so far, is that right?
Yeah, we have.
That's amazing. Well done, first of all. Wow. Like half of our work at Literal Humans is charity work. So let's just jump in and want to like frame the problem, the challenge that you're dealing with for our audience. Why do you think it is that the third sector is so much slower in adopting these new technologies and these technology-based approaches than the private sector? Just like, yeah, big, broad, easy question to start off.
Cool. It's a good question to start with, actually, because, well, to understand why the sector is the way it is, you kind of need some context as well. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we noticed as well is that unlike any other sector, the charity sector is bound by financial constraints mm-hmm. and public scrutiny. And when that happens, every pound needs to be carefully considered. And when this happens, the sector's decision makers are forced to operate in a culture that is essentially very, very risk averse. Mm-hmm. And because of that, when you're operating in a sector that's really risk averse, the creativity and experimentation are often incredibly limited. And what that means then is that like change and adoption are often frowned upon based off of the fear that if you get something wrong, then you will have to deal with the consequences of that. And that often supersedes any need to change, even if it means potentially maximizing how much money you could make as a charity. It's probably also worth adding like a D&I perspective on this as well. Yeah. A lot of the people in the rooms, if you have a look at them, they often look the same and sound the same. And that means that often the ideas that are brought to the table are the same too. So charities are almost trapped in a box of essentially their own design, right? Yeah. And this came to light more so when I was doing my postgraduate studies. They revealed the statistic that a third of the decision makers in the room, their names were John and Michael, which speaks volumes about the types of diversity we were seeing in the charity sector. Mm-hmm. And to add to that, I was also the youngest person on the course by just shy of a decade. And that trait kind of followed me around to every other charity that I worked with after that too. Because again, the people that were being involved in charities tended to be a little older, and that meant that they weren't so connected to things like digital. So yeah, all of this, I guess, became like a huge barrier for a lot of charities, and it continues to be a barrier for charities to adopt new things like technology.
And how would you say your organization is like navigating through that? Like these are sort of almost like perennial existential problems that the charity sector faces. You know, like how have you figured out a way to deal with like lack of representation and lack of sort of cultural competency and all these different things in the work that you're doing? Just another high level easy question. But yeah.
To be completely honest, we allow data to navigate us through everything. Mm. When we had our first proof of concept client and we basically were experimenting with a digital strategy, like in true startup grit on a kitchen table, and we brought about a return of about 12x, we knew then we were onto something. Right. And once we've made that case study the poster child for our success, it did open up a lot of doors. Although majority of the times I do find, even personally myself, I tend to be the only woman in the room, even if we're working with like faith-based charities or even conservation charities and things that you think typically wouldn't be held down by the constraints of like gender, it still tends to be the case. But to be honest, as long as you have the data to back you up, you can open doors with that. And that's kind of what we lead with.
That's a powerful message too, like the universal language of like results and metrics, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And kind of getting people galvanized, especially in the charity sector around like, look, we're here to like serve a mission and to serve communities. And like, if we can anchor ourselves in that and make that our sort of North Star, then magical things can happen. And you know, let's move some of the other stuff to the side. So that's really powerful. Just to also frame that problem, I see here, nonprofits spend roughly $1 on tech for every $3 at the private sector spends. And insane. Like, to,
I mean, I'd argue that in some sectors, it's probably even less than that.
Right.
But yeah, it's a wild stat and it isn't surprising at all, to be fair.
Right, right. So a question about like sort of the future. So like, how do you see fundraising evolving in the nonprofit sector, and kind of like what specific strategy, if we can get into the specifics of what you do, has Cerealbox employed to kind of deliver more impactful fundraising campaigns for charities and nonprofits?
So a lot of it was essentially, the first stage was kind of deconstructing some of the misconceptions that charities had around fundraising. So one of them being that it's an expensive form of advertising. And if you compare traditional to digital, it tends to not be as expensive because you have the freedom of movement to change your or adjust your campaign in a way that reflects better results, right? So that was like a huge misconception we had to deconstruct. And then another one being that like organic digital marketing is the same as paid marketing. I feel like the ice bucket challenge back in 2020 set us on a negative course for charities to understand what digital can do. There's an assumption there that there is like a recipe to go viral and that everybody cares about every cause. But the truth is, you have to get the right cause in front of the right people at the right time. And that's what makes them care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the virality thing is really interesting because people are like, I'm just going to do viral. Like, it's a thing I just turn on.
I'm just going to switch it on.
Yeah, flick viral switch and it is now viral. But yeah, that is a challenge I think like people in the marketing space like face, is like, you know, people chasing virality instead of like really understanding the components of it. And the, as you said, timing and sort of, content, stuff like that. So
Most definitely. So once we came to a place where we essentially deconstructed some of these ideas with some of our clients and then started to think about how charities can essentially navigate through this space. A lot of it was just taking lessons from the for-profit sector and applying them to a non-profit context. And what that meant is, the same way that you receive an ad of like some influencer talking about a product that they really like, you could essentially apply that same model to a charity and it does deliver results. I would be cautious though in thinking about the types of content that you push out, because different types of content talk to different types of people. We test rigorously at Cerealbox as well to find the winning combination and the winning recipe for each client too.
Would love to hear a story about like a particularly successful campaign you ran where like storytelling played a crucial role and like what lessons you learned from it.
Most definitely. So the first one that comes to mind was, we were working with this disaster and humanitarian relief charity. They had some healthy budget to produce a commercial and they wanted a high production commercial with all the bells and whistles of a regular ad. Yeah. We love a cinematic ad, right? And the ad was great. People loved it. But in parallel, we had one of their aid workers that was on the ground walk around and just make videos about what was happening, who he was helping, what they were doing. And the analogy we gave him was, speak to the camera as though you're speaking to a friend on FaceTime. And those videos outperformed the commercial, the cinematic ad, by a landslide. And even though we tested them with controlled variables and we tried to keep as much as we can the same, it was a massive lesson in understanding that it's not just the stories you tell, but it's how you tell those stories as well. And it's our blueprint to charities about how it doesn't have to be expensive, it's free to shoot a video like that.
And I think people are finding too that like, the I think there's even data about this, that like the less cinematic, more personal, more sort of like, you know, quick, like ad hoc, oh, I'm just throwing something up here, tends to play better in many cases than the big cinematic, well-produced sort of piece of content, especially a video. So that's really interesting to see that bear out.
Yeah, most definitely. I think authenticity plays a key role, especially when it comes to charities, because what you're not selling a product, you're almost selling a feeling, and that feeling has to translate through the content. The best way to do that is to get people to do that.
Selling a feeling, that's really well said. Curious to hear, like, beyond storytelling, everyone's like into storytelling now.
We're all gonna, most
but definitely. Like, what are other tactics and approaches that you've seen work really well in the context of driving fundraising results for NGOs?
So from a strategic point of view, there are a couple of things that you can think about, and my manager will probably kill me for sharing this, but one of the things that we noticed is that the old school kind of way of doing digital marketing was to pick a target market, pick a demographic, and the more specific you are, the better it's going to be, right? So you're talking demography data, interest data, and all of that.
Psychographic data, all that stuff.
Exactly. And use that as your North Star to target people. But what we found, that that's actually not the most effective way to run your campaigns. Instead, because like AI and machine learning is so strong with a lot of these platforms, it's actually better to target broad and allow the machine learning to find you your best target market. What's really cool about that kind of setting is that the longer you leave the ads on there for, the better they perform, because the machine learning will strengthen as your ad starts to mature.
So creating content for the broadest possible audience, and then the AI figures out how to serve it? Is that, so, just want to understand that. Right?
Yeah. So I would still recommend being specific with your content and still trying to speak to your target market. Yeah. What we found is that when we've tested it against each other and endlessly over a few years, it's better to allow, to put the ad into the big bad world and see which people are attracted to it naturally. Because what that does is it highlights subsets of audiences that you might have overmissed or overlooked. And it also gives you an opportunity to essentially sit back and let the AI do its thing. And when you trust the ad platforms with their like recommended features and settings, that's usually when they work best, because they've built it. They know how it works, right?
So is it that like the AI ML is just better at targeting than humans? Is that kind of the
essentially the gist? They'll basically adjust their targeting strategy based off who has clicked on your ad and interacted with it, and that will strengthen over time.
But they're not yet better at the content and the creative
they're getting there.
Watch out. In terms of like channels, do you focus on any specific channels and why? And just kind of like, what have you learned about which content performs best on which channels? I'm sure it varies from nonprofit to nonprofit, but just, yeah, curious to hear about that.
Obviously, like you said, it varies from nonprofit to nonprofit. It also depends on budget largely. Mm-hmm. But the two that we always put at the forefront of most campaigns is probably Google and Meta. So Meta, including Facebook and Instagram. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we found that these platforms work better than others is because they're structured almost like a marketplace. Mm-hmm. And when you're a seller in the marketplace, it's much easier to like use all the tools at your disposal that are there and to operate in a place that's already structured and set up as a market. Obviously, there's the emergence of things like TikTok, which it can be a powerful tool, but we haven't seen it work particularly well for the charity sector yet. If you're a service,
interesting. Like, what do you reckon? Like, why? Like, is Gen Z not donating? Like, what's going on here?
I think comes down to the types of donors that you're looking for. Like, Gen Z are willing to participate, but I think at the age bracket they're at, they don't have the same amount of disposable income as some of the people on Instagram have. And I think that kind of skews it. And I also think that TikTok is still learning how to build a robust marketplace on their platform too. There's things like TikTok Shop and stuff that work really good for e-commerce brands. But again, if you're a charity, it's not so much you can do there.
So that's a really interesting tidbit. Like, you wouldn't quite at this point recommend charities to like go big on TikTok at, like right now, just given where TikTok is, where the algorithm is. So that's,
I mean, it kind of depends. Like, if they've got like a big healthy budget, I say by all means experiment. It's really hard to make assumptions without having to test, which is why testing is such a big part of what we do at Cereal Box. But for the most part, we always encourage charities, especially if they haven't experimented with digital ads before, to start with Google and Meta, because that will bring about the results that they're probably looking for.
I'm curious about how you, and this kind of gets to my next question, about how you all stay agile and innovative. And like, you know, the world of digital marketing is like fast and demands like, you know, a lot of testing, as you said, and a lot of experimentation. How is this affordable for nonprofits, like for charities? Like we're working with a charity. We might actually bring you into this one. We'll see about that. But like, they have, you know, a shoestring budget, and we have to kind of prove ourselves in the first few months with this budget. And we're going to do it because we're good at what we do. But it's a real challenge. So like, how do you make what are like really, it sounds like really premium services where you really test and you really understand and implement? How do you make that affordable for charities and nonprofits?
I'll answer the first question about remaining agile in this space. So my co-founder and I have always been massive advocates for learning, and even ourselves as well as our team, they're all super nerds when it comes to anything marketing. It does also really help that our team is very impact driven, which means that they understand there's a direct correlation between education and like the impact they can have. Learning this small little tip or watching this video or this seminar means you can build more schools and you can feed more children, and having that connection really helps keep everybody on the ball when it comes to trends and changes. In terms of like making it affordable, I think the biggest thing that people miss out on is that testing doesn't have to be too expensive. Like, Meta itself has so many inbuilt like tools that you can use, including there's one called the Dynamic Creative, which is one which is our favorite. And essentially, this tool basically allows you to test different combinations of a call to action, of a visual. And what it does is it spitballs different variations of these to find the winning combination, and it does it within 48 hours. So your ad spend doesn't have to be very high in order to figure out what your winning combination is. And once you have your winning combination, then it's easy to scale up and put money down.
If this is so like good for the consumer, like how is this scalable, you know, for the ad platforms? Like if the costs are maybe, you know, like I don't know if they're going down, or but it sounds like they're quite reasonable. Like how is that working for the ad platform? Because I think the way we've engaged sometimes with Google is like, you know, they basically give you a bunch of like shitty advice, you know, about like just spend. And then you reach a certain level of spend and then they actually like give you good advice. You get into like the sort of, you know what I mean? So like, I'm trying to understand how that actually works for the ad platforms, but also the nonprofit as well, right?
So we found that like the winning formula in order to find that sweet spot is basically scaling up slowly and continuing to, as you're testing, that's when you want to start scaling up. So as a blueprint, what we do is before we go on to post a bunch of great videos from of on the ground content, we first test like loads of different styles of messaging because different motivations to give might resonate with different types of people. Right. And sometimes we might think that someone might want to give because they're connected to the location, for instance, but it might be a completely different reason. So first we do extensive market research to figure out what people's donor motivations are. And that will come in the form of your basic like primary and secondary research, surveys, focus groups, social listening, which is like massively important and overlooked as well.
About how long does that phase market research take, like when you're onboarding a new client?
Well, we can do it within a week now because our teams go really
good. That's fast.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So we do it within a week. Yeah. It depends, obviously, on surveys kind of take a long time, a bit longer, because we have to rely on the charities network to distribute that out.
Are you using any AI in the process, the market research process?
Yeah, so we do use a couple of AI tools when it comes to like the social listening reports and stuff, because it's easier to pull and data scrape from there.
We just started using a research tool that does kind of like SME interviews for you, basically.
Oh, nice.
I'll share it with you. It's really interesting.
Sounds useful.
Yeah, we'll chat about it. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so once we've completed the market research phase, then we'll pull out, let's say, 6 key themes as to why someone might donate.
Okay.
We'll create very static, very simple and cheap content based off of that. And that's like your standard charity ad, picture of a child or a beneficiary with some words on it. Once we run that, we run variations of different ad copy as well to see what works well. After we've found the winning combination there, that's when we slowly start to scale up and move towards video content. And I think what we've seen as well is that charities in the beginning will have a very conservative budget and they'll see the result and then they'll want to like triple it. But you can't do that.
It has
to be incremental.
Yeah,
and that's when you hit the sweet spot.
Is there any point when you do hit the accelerator and you're just like, okay, we've got the sort of all the research, we've got the initial data that we need to really like pile into this one channel or one tactic? Is there like kind of a a point that you reach there? Just curious about that.
Kind of depends on your timeline and what the market currently looks like. For example, in Ramadan, which is like when majority of Muslims give, and they give generously, some of our charities actually make like 70% of their revenue in that that month alone. So at times like that, you can scale quickly, you can scale fast because there's appetite for it. But outside of that, you need to be careful about what else is going on. And again, scaling slow and steady is probably the best way.
Lots of changes, with Google, like SERP and kind of like Google Ads for search generative experience. How are you all navigating like the sort of shifting sands, as it were?
It's not too challenging. So just before this interview as well, I spoke with our head of Google Ads and I wanted to pick his brain on it too. And thankfully, he said something that was quite reassuring. And he was like, despite all of these changes that happen, for instance, like you mentioned Google SERP, essentially that allows us to get quick answers directly on it on a search page, right?
Yep.
And what that meant for us as an agency is that we just needed to alter and adjust how robust our landing pages were, making sure that they had enough depth and information about the context that this project was operating in. Then making it as well just engaging and having action-driven touch points to help conversion. So that was one of the ways that we've kind of adjusted. But to be fair, he even said, he was like, the blueprint still stays the same. People still, you just have to make what you're putting up there more relevant to what people are searching for. But essentially, again, it's right people, right message.
So. Yeah, the right time. That's interesting. You've talked a lot about like data analytics and like the important role that they play, and kind of be curious like what insights you've gleaned over the past. How long have you all been running for?
Since 2020, so four years.
Same as us. Yeah. So over the past 4 years, like how you've gotten to these data driven insights, and how you've been able to like refine your campaigns and kind of maximize the ROI for your nonprofit clients.
So we touched a little on like testing and how important that is with limited budgets, but having an iterative process. Even when you've laid out to the client a very linear and simple way of how you're going to do this campaign behind the scenes, you still need to remain agile and robust when it comes to responding to the data.
Okay.
And I think that's the difference between like monitoring it, and that's the difference between actually a really good campaign and one that's not going to work so well, is monitoring it and responding to it. So looking at the data, seeing what parts of it's working well, what parts of your campaign seem to work well. Sometimes it can be hard. You'll have a winning combination, you'll put up an ad and you'll think, okay, people are going to love this, it's going to make lots lots of money and then it doesn't. But essentially, you have to continue to remain responsive, I guess, is the best way to put it.
And there, it strikes me that there's like a huge people element to that, because you've got to have like the right human looking at the data who's able to glean the right insights at the right time to inform the campaign, to hit people at the right time, the right place, you know, all that stuff. So like, how have you thought about talent and people and like sort of making sure that you've got, you know, the team that can sort of download that data and understand it and then execute on it?
That's a really great question. Yeah. We don't get asked about our team enough because I love talking about them.
Nice.
But our team are incredible. So it was really hard to find anybody who specialized in this very obscure niche that we operate in. So everybody who we brought to the table, especially in the early stages, we were like, we have this crazy idea. There's no information or any training that we could give you because it doesn't exist. We're just going to wing it and see what happens. And our team has now, I can honestly wholeheartedly say that they are now the experts at digital fundraising because they've taught themselves what makes a great digital fundraising campaign. And oh gosh, I've forgotten your question now.
No, just, I mean, I'm looking at your team, like they're incredibly diverse. They're absolute experts in their field. You know, like I think there's something powerful about like a diverse team of experts that kind of looks like the audiences that they're serving to some extent. Like, I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, most definitely. And that's unfortunately on the website. That's not even all the team. There's about 15 to 20 of us now as well.
Wow.
And one lesson though, that we've learned from this experience of sourcing great talent has been to look just beyond like our immediate networks. Our team is spread out across Dubai, Canada, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the talent that you find there and the commitment is unmatched. And people really have an appetite to learn all around the world. And the boundaries of co-working that like COVID broke down for us meant that we could access these people.
So you've gone broader than the UK talent market purposely. So how do you stitch all that together? Like, how do you build a global team and keep them all, you know, moving in concert?
It's a challenge. I feel really sorry for our account managers because they're always operating on like five different time zones. And like I said, our team is incredibly patient. So sometimes, especially in Ramadan, they were taking like calls at like 3 a.m. for them. So it was really unfortunate. But they, again, I think when you have a team that's committed to the cause and have a passion to be the best in their field, they will do whatever it takes in order to make that happen. We do try to do a lot of like virtual bonding sessions as well to get to know each other. And I think once you go through stressful periods as well together, bonds are made. Hopefully in the future, we're hoping to bring all the team together and tour some of the places that we have helped change.
That'd be amazing, professional development and just like social experience. We do like a drawing game sometimes together. We'll do like a social on Thursday evenings and stuff like that. We have some team members in like Zimbabwe and in Canada, Nigeria, where else, Barcelona and stuff like that. So the team gets to see how poorly their CEO can draw, because I am the worst. Like, I'm both giving design directions and creating design. So it's kind of fun to laugh at me. Curious to hear a bit more about your specific co-founder story, and our listeners just generally like to know about the professional and personal experiences that have led to you to the seat that you're in. So curious if there was like any specific moment that sort of it dawned on you, like, oh, this is the cause I want to dedicate in the next, you know, few years of my professional life to, and like, what was there a moment for you, or what kind of was the catalyst for your work at Cerealbox?
My co-founder and I have been raised together, and we've been doing like lemonade stands stuff since we were kids. We always knew we were going to do something big together. We just never knew what it was. And then we kind of went in completely different directions. He went down the marketing route and I went straight into nonprofits, but I always had a flair for marketing. So I'd always have one foot in with any project that he was working on. And this all kind of came about because as I was working in the nonprofit sector, and I was mainly working in the marketing for these nonprofits, I just noticed that there was just this huge gap between the way nonprofits and for-profits market. And he was at the time was a senior at a marketing agency. And he was, every time I had a problem, he was like, oh, there's this solution, like, just we're doing this. And then we realized that there was a huge gap there. And I think COVID really changed things for us, because when we first came up with that strategy on a kitchen table and we tested it, it was about 2019, and we delivered a really good ROI and we were like really happy about that. And then COVID really set things into work for us, because suddenly all these charities who were fundraising in very traditional ways of like bus ads, billboards, direct mail, nobody was there to open that mail. Nobody was there to see those bus ads, all those billboards. And what that meant for us is that there was a huge influx of charities that were panicking about what they could do with their marketing budgets and how they were going to get people's attention.
Market opportunity.
So honestly, right place, right time as well.
And
then that kind of set things into motion for us. We had the poster child of that one proof of concept client, and word kind of just just got out there. And even now, to date, Cereablox has never done any marketing for ourselves, which we hope to do as we free up our schedules.
You're crushing it with the name and the branding already. Like, it's just like the number. You guys have to go to this website. The number of like puns and cereal references and stuff like that. Like, yeah, really well done. Yeah.
That's unfortunately a trait that I have.
No. Stick with it. Because people like, I mean, branding is so important these days. And that's one thing we've gotten like kind of walked into branding like by accident, because we do content strategy and SEO, and people are like, well, our brand isn't together. And we're like, yeah, we really need to fix that brand and that website before we even talk about growth strategy. So just 100%. Like, we got pulled into it, and just looking at what you guys have done, I mean, it's really impressive. And people remember that. People, you know, brand is a promise, and it's like you guys are sort of, you know, delivering on that, I think, in a lot of ways. So
it's
impressive.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah. Sorry, cut you off there.
No worries. Yeah. So essentially, COVID changed it for us and set things into motion for us. We haven't done any marketing, and everyone who's come to us has come through referrals.
That's
or
great.
They've heard about what we've done and the results we've delivered. And yeah, and it's worked pretty well so far. So funny that you mentioned all the branding and stuff, because we always get asked about it, and they're like, it's so random. And because we operate in such an almost mundane and it can be quite depressing sector sometimes, the name always and the colors, they always stick out to people.
No, but it's great, because it's like, I mean, I also, there's something like sort of warm and comforting, and like it's sort of like home. I feel like I grew up with cereal, like especially being a kid from the US, and like just like, you know, like it's, I don't know, it's nourishing in a way, and it's very like, and it's sweet too, so it's like a little bit naughty and tantalizing, but also like it, you know, like it's you're getting your energy for the day as well. So like, I think it's you've nailed it, I think, in
Thank
terms of the branding.
Those are all the things we're trying to bring to the charity sector.
That's really, no, keep at it. I mean, it's really good. We try to ask folks for advice, and so we like to ask them like, what's worked for you? So like, you know, that maybe there's like a young Zainab out there who's like listening to this and like is maybe going to start their organization that's focused on marketing and in the charity sector or something else. Like, what's worked for you? Maybe one thing personally, and then one thing professionally, in terms of like, you know, accelerating and supporting your journey to where you are today.
Personally, it was just take risks. As daunting as scary as it might be, just take the risks. Because honestly, it's the biggest cliche, but like, you honestly don't know what opportunity is going to fall your way or what something can grow into. When we started Cereablox, we thought there's no way we can convince charities to come do this wild thing with us.
Yeah.
And thankfully now we've helped so many charities, and we've been part of so many causes that we weren't even aware of. So yeah, I definitely say if you have an idea, just take that risk. I'd also say, like, one of the things that always confused me growing up is I come from a family of essentially academics. My sister's a doctor, my other one's a psychologist, and they all went into like the medical health field and knew exactly what they wanted to do. I had no clue. At another interview I was at, they asked like, what did I want to be as a child? And I remember my dad, I think he still has this piece of homework, and it was like, what do you want to do when you're older? And I was like, do good stuff. And that was like the most I knew. And I guess the point being, like, you don't have to have a clear set path towards something.
Yeah.
If you've got a vibe of what you want to do, chase that and follow your instincts, and it will lead you somewhere if you put the time in.
I like that. Chase the vibe, take risks. That's a
good chase the vibe.
Good sort of vibe.
From a professional perspective, I would say cross-sector learning, because that's been the key that's held up Cereablox and is at the forefront of everything we do. A lot of the answers that we needed, we couldn't find in the sector we were operating in. And it's only even now when we go beyond it that we find all the answers that we're looking for.
I think it's a really important piece too, because like, I think we now live in a world where it's like easy to, you know, any of us can sort of go down the rabbit hole. We can go deep because we have this incredible tool, the internet, and now, you know, generative AI and stuff like that. But like, the people who are able to stitch it together across different sectors, I think are the ones, you know, the ones who have range across different disciplines are the ones who are going to kind of win in the future and are building organizations that can do that as well. And I think that's empowering, but also scary in a way, because it forces people maybe who have gotten comfortable being specialists kind of to lift their heads up and like look cross-sectorally and interdisciplinary. So that's one thing I think we try to pride ourselves is like, you know, everyone on our team is a strategist, you know, everyone, even if you're a writer, a designer, or a social media maven, like you're also a strategist, you know, and you kind of have to think laterally as well. So
that's a good tip. I'm going to take that Cereablox.
definitely do it. Curious to hear about, just as like kind of a wrap up thought, is predictions you have. Cause we've like looked at some of the data about, you know, at least in the States, like nonprofit giving declining and like people, you know, concerned about, you know, levels of giving for like, you know, new generations and things like that, and just like a general worry, you know, especially in the nonprofit sector about like, where's this going, you know, in terms of the stability. So yeah, just curious to hear what you see coming down the pike in terms of charitable giving, nonprofit, you know, development, and any predictions you might have.
Cool. So off the bat anyway, like, we've seen people's relationships with individual giving change anyway. And the way charities are viewing individual giving is shifting as well. I mean, there's been more appetite to experiment with things like social media, which has been good. But we're also seeing really fun developments in like tools as well. So some of the charities that we worked with through Ramadan, they created like donor automation tools that basically allowed you to schedule your donations across a set period of time. So you could set it and forget it and just continue.
Like monthly donations? Or
essentially, it would be like monthly donations, but it happens every day, because especially for periods like Ramadan, where people get rewarded for giving every single day. So it makes sense to maximize that.
It's called zakat, is that right?
So there's zakat and there's sadqa. Well done.
I'm trying to do a little research, you know.
That's really impressive. But essentially, it was like that. And having a small amount of your donation go out every day meant that the donation value was much higher, because people were giving all their donation for the full 30 days in one go. So it allowed them to budget properly and therefore give more. So that was a really exciting tool that we saw more of. And I think we'll probably see more things like that. I'm also a mentor for this really cool project hosted by the Mosaic Makers. And basically they're a community of like change makers, of mainly Muslim, who are attempting essentially to use tech as well for good. And they hosted this thing called a build challenge with one of our clients, a charity, right? And they've got like a team of such incredible and skilled professionals in the tech space who are all competing to build a tech solution for this charity. And there's something like 50 teams as well, and they've all got about like at least 8 or 9 people in it, and they're all working on these really, really exciting solutions. So I do think that there is appetite, especially with this upcoming generation, to bridge the gap between tech and social good, especially as we're seeing people be more values driven. So I'm excited to see where it goes, to be honest.
You see that with Gen Z, like demanding that the, you know, sort of the brands that they buy from, and I think millennials sort of carved a space for this as well, if I could give us some credit. You know, like to demand of brands like to be sort of values driven and execute on those brands. I mean, it's, you know, hit or miss. There's lots of stuff going on, fast fashion and all this stuff, you know. But it seems like it's hopefully heading in a promising direction. And cool. Well, where can folks find out more about Cereal Box and the work that you're doing, and any where can they find you in interwebs, and any shout outs you want to make?
So first shout out to my co-founder Jamal. None of this would be possible without him. He is the machine that keeps Cereal Box going. So shout out to him. And then in terms of keeping up with Cereal Box, unfortunately we don't do too much marketing, Paul. We really need to, but LinkedIn, you can follow Jamal or myself, or our Cereal Box page. But then you could also just have a look at our website and appreciate that branding and all those puns.
And that's cerealboxagency.com, right?
That's
and
the
like
one.
If you're in for like a treat, if you really like say like me, if you're into cereal and cereal related puns and humor, please go to cerealboxagency.com. I mean, we're really big fans. Half of our work is charity and nonprofit work, and helping them with like branding and content strategy and stuff like that. So like adjacent to, I think, what you're doing. And once we came across you, we're like, we got to get these guys in the pod. So like, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and how results driven you are in a sector that I think like doesn't get enough credit for the good work that they do and what they deliver for people, and the fact that the way and the method that you're supporting them is really powerful. So
thank you.
I'm so grateful that we got a chance to talk to you today.
Likewise. Would you like to hear the story about why it's called Cereal Box?
no worries. I don't want to miss that. Please.
It's so funny though, because me and my co-founder have two completely different answers for this. But my answer was that it, like, you know how you talked about it's so connected to your childhood? It was literally exactly that. That was the first form of conscious marketing that I ever consumed.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like picking up toys out of the cereal box, or you know, we in London used to get like tickets to amusement parks and stuff in a cereal box. You'd end up cutting it up, and it was the first form of conscious marketing, which is why we chose Cereal Box. It's also fun because it creates so many branding opportunities, like with the cereal puns, or we create custom cereal boxes for our 12-month clients, which they always really love. And
any like sponsorship possibilities from like some of the big? I mean, it just seems like a slam dunk for
it
them.
Seems like you just want a cereal box, Paul.
I really do now that I'm actually fasting right now. So when you mentioned Ramadan, I was like, oh man, I'm just gonna go having so much cereal when I go home. So but cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. We've been talking about revolutionizing digital fundraising with Zainab Tarek, co-founder and COO of Cereal Box Agency. Thanks for jumping on the pod today. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having me, Paul. It's been great.
Awesome. And as always, folks, please like, subscribe, smash the join subscribe button, and give us a 5-star rating so we can bring more great guests like Zainab onto the podcast. Thanks for joining.